Hey, Prime members, you can listen to Tides of History ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the app today.
The August sun had baked the hills and ridges a variety of shades of greenish-brown, speckled here and there with bare white rock jutting through the grass and brush. Dry canyons and gorges snaked through the network of high ridges and dramatic peaks, all of them leading down toward a flat, fertile plain, an oasis here in the western reaches of Azerbaijan. Two armies had come to this plain on August 23, 1514, tens of thousands of soldiers all driven by the implacable wills of two men. One of them, a short, powerfully built fellow, ran his fingers through a red beard that covered a fair face, burnt deeply by the sun of Anatolia and Iran and shaded only a bit by a large white turban. The man carefully watched the army of the Ottoman Sultan deploy on the plain, Sipahi cavalry from Greece and Serbia and Turkomans from central Anatolia on the wings, the tall white hats of the Sultan's slave soldier janissaries behind a line of wagons in the center. The harsh sunlight glinted off long arquebuses and the barrels of cannon and mortars. It reflected off chainmail and conical helmets. It caught flashes on polished metal shields and the blades of swords. The red-bearded man pondered for a moment. Should he attack? He glanced at his sides, saw thousands upon thousands of cavalry drawn up and ready for battle, his loyal Kizilbash. White turbans with distinctive red crowns on top, curved swords, long lances, short composite bows, quivers full of arrows ready to be launched at the Ottomans. All of them marked out the Kizilbash as a force to be reckoned. But what made them special, what had driven them to conquests everywhere from Dagestan and the Caucasus to Baghdad to Kabul to Samarkand, was their utter belief in the red-bearded man. He was invincible, they thought, the shadow of God on earth. Ismail, that was the red-bearded man's name, was the representative of the 12th Imam, perhaps even the 12th Imam himself, the rightful leader of the Muslim world, as close to the divine as existed here on earth. He was Shah, Sheikh, the embodiment of ultimate religious authority and final political power, and much, much more besides. At least in their eyes. Should he attack? Ismail asked himself again. No, he thought, not yet. All would be as God decreed. There would be a battle. Bowstrings would twang, launching arrows at the foe by the hundreds and thousands. Lances would spit the Ottoman cavalry, curved swords slash open the bellies and faces of the janissaries. Ismail had always won before. In every battle of his 27 years, God had smiled on him, shown that his path, his will, was correct. He would win again, of that he was sure, and his Kizilbash were just as certain. This plain of Chaldiran would run red with blood. The outcome of the conflict between Ismail and Selim, Sultan of the Ottoman Empire, would be as God decreed. The future of the Muslim world was at hand. Hi, everybody. From Wondery, welcome to another episode of Tides of History. I'm Patrick Wyman. Thanks for joining me. At the end of the 15th century, the Islamic world stretched from the Straits of Gibraltar to the desert fringes of China, from the sweltering trading ports of Mozambique and Kilwa in East Africa to the grim fortresses lining the Danube River. It encompassed half the world, dozens of different languages, and a staggering array of ethnic diversity. Turkic-speaking nomads living in yurts and tending their flocks on the grassy steppe. Prim and proper scholars debating the fine points of theology and law in a richly decorated school in Cairo. Teenaged slaves taken from their homes in the rural Balkans, transported to Istanbul and converted to Islam, training with arquebus and bow and sword, soon to become janissaries of the Ottoman Sultan. Wealthy, cultured, Arabic and Persian-speaking merchants of Calicut and Goa on the southwestern coast of India, making their living plying the lucrative trading routes of the Indian Ocean. At the center of that vast, complex, diverse world lay a contest for preeminence. For centuries, the Mamluk sultans of Egypt held the prestige and the power, thanks to their defeat of the Mongols and their guardianship over Mecca and Medina. But times were changing. The Ottomans, Anatolian frontier warlords turned aspirants to world power, were on the rise. They had already conquered much of the former Byzantine Empire in the Balkans, and they had spent decades knocking on the doors of Christendom. Now, under the rule of a succession of talented sultans, they were turning their attention toward the leadership of the Islamic world. Last time on Tides, we talked about the Ottoman struggle with the Mamluks of Egypt. After the Ottomans expanded eastward in the second half of the 15th century, the two states shared an increasingly unstable border in eastern Anatolia and northern Syria. These great power frictions combined with a much deeper ideological conflict over leadership of the Muslim world. Would it be the venerable Mamluks or the upstart Ottomans? It took one grinding, inconclusive war from 1485 to 1491, and a second, sharper, and much more decisive conflict 25 years later, but the Ottomans eventually emerged victorious. Over the course of a few decades, the Ottomans went from being a mostly European power with a small presence in the Islamic world to its central force. But the conflict with the Mamluks was only half of this eastward expansion into the traditional realms of Islam. The Ottomans had another foe, a more dangerous one, that emerged in the wild frontier spaces of eastern Anatolia, Azerbaijan, and the Iranian plateau. These were the Safavids, led by a singularly gifted and pivotal figure, Shah Ismail, the founder of a new dynasty and a new state that would survive for more than 250 years. Ismail was just 12 years old when he came to power, but he seemed to be invincible. At least until he met the Ottoman Sultan Selim the Grim, he of the hard face, aggressive tendencies, and unbending will. Over the course of today's episode, we'll trace the origins of the Safavids and try to understand why they represented such a serious threat to the Ottomans, why Selim was concerned enough about them to take over his father's throne and make open war on his rivals to the east. In the process, we'll venture into the vast and, at least on this show, underexplored spaces of the Islamic world. Before we get to the Ottoman-Safavid conflict, we need to ground ourselves in some of the basic dynamics of medieval Islam and the Islamic world more generally. You're probably aware of the deepest and most fundamental split within Islam, the Sunni-Shia divide, which came into being soon after the death of the Prophet Muhammad. It's all pretty complicated, but the gist of it has to do with the succession to the caliphate, the combined role of religious and political leadership after Muhammad's death. Over the course of many centuries, substantial doctrinal, theological, and political differences emerged between these two basic subsets. Most Muslims were Sunni, but different schools of Shia thought and practice took hold in different times and places. For a while, the Ismailis were the most important, ruling Egypt in the form of the Fatimid Caliphate, which lasted from 909 to 1171. The famous sect of assassins, Hashashiyan in Persian, were Ismailis. By the 15th century, the Twelver Shia were the more important of the two. The differences between the Ismailis and Twelvers began with conflicting views as to who was the rightful imam, the proper leader of the Muslim Ummah, the community of believers, in the line of succession from Muhammad. Ismailis and Twelvers agreed on the first six imams, but diverged from there. It's all very complicated and very messy, and very interesting in its own right, but it's not strictly relevant for us here, at least not yet. We could spend years on it and still just scratch the surface. The key thing to remember in the period that we're talking about here is that the Sunni-Shia split actually wasn't that important. The later Middle Ages have been called an era of Sunni-Shia syncretism, when the differences between the two faded for a variety of reasons. It's not so much that the divide ceased to exist, it was still around and flared up again soon, as we'll see, but that there were other axes of differentiation within the practice of Islam that mattered more in those times and places. As you'd expect, given the scope and scale and diversity of the Muslim world, there were some pretty substantial variations in how people practiced their faith. If that was true for Christendom, with its vast gap between illiterate rural parishioners and university-trained theologians, sword-swinging hospitaller monks-slash-knights and impoverished wandering friars, it was even more the case for medieval Muslims. Their world was much larger, much more populous, and encompassed a great deal more of the globe. It makes sense that it contained just as much, if not substantially more, divergence in practice and belief. The fundamental divide in this period, and throughout the history of Islam, in fact, lies between the mystical and legal aspects of faith, between inner belief and direct contact with the divine, and outer conformity to communal standards of practice. Think of this as a continuum or a spectrum, not an either-or choice. Most Muslims, then and now, combined aspects of both traditions in their spiritual lives. At one end of the spectrum, the legal end, was Sharia, the umbrella term for the vast and complex array of Muslim legal traditions. There were a variety of schools of law within the Sharia tradition with different emphases, approaches, and geographic bases, all of them devoted to explaining how Muslims should live their daily lives. At the other end of the spectrum, the mystical end, was Sufism, again, an umbrella term encompassing a huge array of different inwardly focused practices of Muslim belief. As there were a variety of schools of law, there were also a variety of different Sufi orders. Some of them were minor and local, and others spread out all over the Muslim world. Now, the mystic legal axis didn't map onto the Sunni-Shia divide. There were Shia legalists and Sufis who adhered to a Sunni conception of Islamic tradition. And there were Shia-leaning Sufis and Sunni legalists, too. On top of that, there were plenty of regular believers all over the Muslim world who weren't especially invested in any of those labels. But there were some general patterns, ways in which these various traditions mapped onto other kinds of distinctions. Legalistic forms of Islam tended to be more prominent in the urban and settled parts of the Muslim world. The Sufi mystics, the charismatic holy men who founded widespread orders, tended to find more supporters among the nomads of the steppe. Again, this wasn't hard and fast, just a general dynamic. There were legalists among the nomads and Sufis among the city dwellers. But the key thing to note here is that there were limits. This wasn't a free-for-all. Certain beliefs were, in fact, considered to be out of bounds, unorthodox, and generally unacceptable. The blanket term for these unacceptable beliefs was gulu, usually translated as something like extremism. The noun form, gulat, extremists, was much more common. The root word actually means something more like exaggerator. It was less adherence to a specific kind of belief than taking them too far. For example, and this is something we'll come back to, it might mean investing a holy man with a little more divine inspiration than was acceptable, or seeing one of the early imams in Shia history as a divine figure. In the late 15th century, to be labeled gulat was to be outside the wide range of orthodox belief, to be set apart from the mainstream of Islamic society, both Sunni and Shia. These kinds of beliefs tended to be most common on the fringes of the Muslim world, in the broad frontier zone where the steppe bled into the settled, urban civilization of the Middle East. This brings us around to the second major dynamic of the Muslim world that we need to talk about. Its staggering ethnic diversity. Islam had begun among the Arabs of the Arabian Peninsula, but it found converts far beyond its homeland. In sub-Saharan Africa, among the Berbers of the Sahara and North Africa, the various Persian speakers of the Iranian plateau and Central Asia, and the Turkic speakers of the Great Eurasian Steppe. Arabs dominated the early caliphate, but before long, a synthesis emerged among these major ethnic groups, each of which contributed different things to the broader emerging Islamic world. Legal traditions from the Arabs, Persian court culture and bureaucratic practices and conceptions of rulership, and military muscle from the nomadic groups on the fringes. The Berbers were the backbone of the Muslim expansion into Spain. Just about everywhere else, Turkic speakers soon emerged as the military class, and eventually ruling dynasties, of settled Muslim states, even those far from the steppe. Ethnic diversity was the rule. And that created a continuously repeated pattern of both structural strengths and weaknesses. The combination of nomadic military expertise with efficient bureaucracy, political ideology, and legal stability was a potent one. But at the same time, these were also fault lines within Islamic states that could rupture under the right circumstances. The final dynamic is something we've already touched on, but it has to do with the geography of the Muslim world and the different ways of life and culture that geography helped to produce. From the Black Sea to Central Asia and beyond, the Muslim world encompassed both the nomads of the steppe and the settled agriculturalists and city dwellers of the Silk Road, the Iranian Plateau, and Anatolia. This was a zone of interaction several thousand miles long and a thousand deep, where political concepts traveled in both directions, legal and mystical religious traditions grew and found adherents, where empires were born, expanded, contracted, and died. The interaction between the settled and the nomadic defined much of Islamic history. Repeated cycles of invasions and migrations from the steppe, conversions to Islam, peaceful and violent interactions with the settled world, and new dynasties from the steppe establishing themselves among the states on the fringes and beyond. Wash, rinse, and repeat over and over and over again. The Mongols differed from their predecessors only in the scale of their expansion. At the far western fringe of this world lay Anatolia, the region encompassing the Asian portions of modern-day Turkey and its neighbors in the southern reaches of the Caucasus Mountains. East of this lay Azerbaijan, the westernmost extension of the Persian world, and then the Iranian plateau. What's essential to remember about this region is that it was a frontier. Rocky, mountains, often inhospitable and accessible to newcomers from the steppe. This was a crossroads, a place inhabited and controlled largely by Turkic-speaking pastoralists, themselves often recent arrivals from the open steppe. It was a land of high, lush green pastures and soaring snow-covered peaks, home to wandering nomads with their flocks, bows, and horses. Warlords fought, raided, rose, and fell, building states that could last a few years or centuries. Sufi holy men made their names and attracted followers, building potent religious and sometimes political organizations. This was a wild, turbulent place, birthplace and graveyard of empires. The Ottoman state had come into being on its fringes. Their new and dangerous rivals, the Safavids, were likewise born here. Both emerged in a heady stew of religious enthusiasm, volatile politics, and a steady supply of talented warriors from the steppe.
If I asked you how many subscriptions you have, would you be able to list all of them and how much you're paying? If you would have asked me this question before I started using Rocket Money, I would have said yes. But let me tell you, I would have been so wrong. I can't believe how many I had and all the money I was wasting. Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has helped save its members an average of $720 a year with over 500 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/Wondery. That's rocketmoney.com/Wondery. rocketmoney.com/Wondery. When it comes to hiring, don't go searching for the one. Just meet your match with Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/match. Just go to Indeed.com/match right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Indeed.com/match. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
One of the ironies of this period is that the Safavids and the Ottoman Empire emerged at almost exactly the same time. Osman I was born in the 1250s. So too was Sheikh Safi al-Din Ardabili, the founder of the Safavid order. The distance from western Anatolia, where Osman was born, to Safi al-Din's home in Ardabil in western Iran was about 1,000 miles. In many ways, they inhabited very similar worlds. They emerged from much the same stew, where Turkic-speaking nomads raided for profit and fought for glory and power amid settled communities. Mostly Greek in western Anatolia and Persian around Ardabil. But where the Ottomans were frontier warlords from the very beginning, the Safavids got their start as something very different. Safi al-Din was a Sufi holy man, a sheikh. The Safavids, Safaviyya, were a Sufi order, not the seed of a new state. This is essential to bear in mind. Religion mattered to the Ottomans. as they came into being in an environment suffused with mystical Islam and Sufi holy men who preached Gaza, holy war, against Christians for both faith and profit. But politics were initially secondary to the Safavids, rather than vice versa. They were holy men first, leaders of a Sufi order, and political players second. One quick note here. I'm drawing heavily on the historian Roger Savary's classic book, Iran Under the Safavids, for most of what follows. So, at first, the Safaviyya appeared to be little different than the other Sufi orders common throughout this part of the Muslim world and beyond. But Sheikh Safi was sharp, dedicated, and seen as worthy of respect. He had not technically founded his order, but took it over from another prominent and well-regarded holy man, Sheikh Zahid, who already had prominent followers. Sheikh Safi extended his reach throughout the whole region, winning followers and devotees in eastern Anatolia and Syria. Among them was a great vizier of the Ilkhans, the recently converted Mongol rulers of Persia, and important Ilkhanid emirs, key nobles. Safi's son, Sheikh Sadr al-Din Musa, took over the order from him at his death in 1334 and expanded even further. Thousands upon thousands of the Turkomans who inhabited the region became disciples of the Safavids, traveling to their home base in Ardabil for spiritual guidance and instruction. When you hobnob with the powerful, as the Safavids had already begun to do, getting involved in politics is inevitable. Again, that wasn't out of the ordinary for Sufi orders of this time and place. They could even act as the catalyst for powerful political movements, movements that channeled the constant tensions between military nomads, settled bureaucrats and agrarian states, and authority more generally. Later Safavid traditions held that even the great warlord Timurlenk, Tamerlane, became a disciple of the Safavid sheikh at the end of the 14th century. There's no contemporary evidence for this, but it speaks to how people saw the intimate connections between spiritual authority and political influence in this time and place. As son followed father into leadership of the Safavids, their influence grew, and so too did their ambitions. Under the leadership of Sheikh Ibrahim, the fourth head of the Safavids from 1427 to 1447, they organized themselves. Officers of the order maintained close contact with their disciples across eastern Anatolia and Iran. Donations of money and rich presents flowed into their headquarters at Ardabil. Charismatic spiritual leadership increasingly joined worldly wealth. Temporal leadership, real political power, was only a short step away. That transition came with the accession of Junayd, the son of Ibrahim, in 1447. Ibrahim had already conducted himself like a king, the sources tell us. Junayd simply took it one step further, calling himself Sultan, which implies temporal authority and rulership, and telling his many thousands of followers to engage in holy war against the infidel. Junayd himself led raids north of the Caucasus into territory held by Christians. Now, as you might expect, this didn't exactly endear Junayd to the actual rulers of this territory, the Karakoyunlu, or the Black Sheep Turkomans, who ruled much of what's now eastern Turkey, northwestern Iran, and the southern Caucasus Mountains. In the early 1450s, the Karakoyunlu ruler Jahan Shah told Sheikh Junayd to get out of Ardabil, dismiss his followers, and then leave Karakoyunlu territory, or be destroyed. Junayd, wisely, did as he was told. But Junayd didn't give up. Instead, he went looking for help. He found it in the form of the Akkoyunlu, the White Sheep Turkomans, led by the capable warlord Uzun Hasan. We've met Uzun Hasan before, back when he clashed with Mehmet the Conqueror and the Ottomans in the 1470s. Uzun Hasan was a wily operator, a skillful ruler, and a sharp politician, and he knew an opportunity when he saw one. Junayd was just that, an opportunity. The charismatic leader of a widespread religious organization with thousands of followers and serious material resources. That was a tool that could be turned to Uzun Hasan's purposes. So Uzun Hasan married his sister to Junayd and supported him when he led an army north toward the Caucasus in 1460. Junayd's purpose was reportedly to raid the Christians living in the Caucasus, in either Georgia or what's now Dagestan. In reality, Junayd was probably trying to conquer the Muslim state of Shirvan, centered on the city of Baku in what's now Azerbaijan. Junayd and Uzun Hasan presumably intended to use Shirvan as a base for attacking the Karakoyunlu. In any case, Junayd failed. He was killed in battle by the Shirvan Shah, the ruler of Shirvan, either on his way back from the raid into Georgia or while making an attempt to conquer Shirvan. Later Safavid sources, predictably, wouldn't play up a failed conquest of a fellow Muslim state. This crushing defeat in 1460 wasn't enough to put an end to the Safavids or their ambitions. By this point, their spirituality was growing increasingly extreme, further outside the bounds of orthodoxy and mainstream Islam, both Sunni and Shia. Junayd's followers reportedly addressed him as God, and this was just one manifestation of their heterodoxy. Sheikh Junayd left behind an infant son to succeed him as the head of the Safavid order, a boy named Haidar, and his followers immediately proclaimed the baby's divinity. But why did they think that the baby Haidar was divine? How did this fit into the broader currents of Islamic belief and practice? One way of explaining this is to say that the Safavids were increasingly identified with Twelver Shiism, one of the two main branches of Shia belief, as we talked about a little while ago. Basically, Twelvers believe that 12 divinely ordained imams, the rightful leaders of the Muslim community, followed Muhammad, beginning with his son-in-law, Ali. The 12th imam's birth was hidden, and he remains in hiding, called occultation, even now. The 12th imam will emerge from hiding as the Mahdi, and, along with Jesus, redeem the world. Various people throughout history have claimed to be the Mahdi, and led a variety of movements, some of which survive today. The Safavid context is pretty confusing. There are not a lot of reliable contemporary sources here. But what seems clear is that by Haidar's time, 1460, they were either claiming to be the representatives of the 12th Imam or even to be the 12th Imam. A little ambiguity was probably helpful for them. Now, among the Turkomans, the nomadic warriors who inhabited this whole region, there was a long tradition of interest in and devotion to charismatic holy figures who made claims of divine inspiration or even divinity itself. The Safavids not only fit neatly into this mold, but did it with extreme effectiveness. This was what made them gulat, extremists. Despite the fact that there was a major audience for their claims and their particular brand of mystical religion, it stood a long way outside the bounds of orthodox Muslim thought. In essence, the Safavids had become a messianic movement that aimed at worldly political power to impose their religious views. They found followers among the Turkomans, not just because of the charisma of their preaching, but also because they spoke to a series of broader tensions. The tension between nomad and settled, Turk and Persian, law and mysticism, inner and outer forms of religiosity, and last but not least, between authority and freedom. Military glory, spiritual fulfillment, material rewards, a place in the world. This was what messianic movements offered, and it's why the Safavids had so much success recruiting followers among the Turkomans. Little Haidar grew up under the protection of his grandfather, Uzun Hasan. Uzun Hasan destroyed the Karakoyunlu and took the whole region, returning Ardabil and the hereditary Safavid base of power to the order. Haidar married another Akkoyunlu princess, a cousin, whose mother happened to be the daughter of the Byzantine emperor of Trebizond, one of the remnant states of the Byzantine Empire. In effect, the Safavid sheikhs were knitting themselves into the highest levels of political leadership in the area. At the same time, they retained their role as charismatic religious leaders. Inwardly, wrote a later Safavid chronicler of Haidar, following the example of sheikhs and men of God, he walked the path of spiritual guidance and defense of the faith. Outwardly, he was a leader sitting on a throne in the manner of princes. But after the death of Uzun Hasan, an event that destabilized not only the Akkoyunlu but the whole region, Haidar lost his worldly protector. The new Akkoyunlu ruler, Haidar's cousin and Uzun Hasan's son, a guy named Yakub, came to fear the sheikh. Haidar gathered more and more followers and won glory and prestige for himself by raiding the Christians of the Caucasus, Ossetians and Circassians mostly. Old Uzun Hasan had enough prestige and power to believe that he could use Haidar and the Safavid order for his own political purposes. His son Yakub, fresh off civil war and internal conflict, didn't have that luxury. When Haidar set off on another raid in 1488, passing through the territory of Shirvan as his father had done, the Akkoyunlu ruler made a deal with the ruler of Shirvan. They sent a combined force that demolished the Safavids and killed Haidar along with many of his followers. Yet still, the Safavids wouldn't go away. Shortly before his death, Haidar had devised a distinctive marker for his followers, a red hat with 12 points signifying the 12 imams. The Ottomans derisively called these followers Kizilbash, redheads, a name they took up with relish. The Kizilbash were a potent and growing force, with thousands upon thousands of followers spread over the fringes of Ottoman territory in eastern Anatolia, through the Akkoyunlu power base in western Iran, and in the traditional Safavid homeland of Azerbaijan. Haidar was just 29 when he died in 1488, but he'd been busy over the course of his brief life, leaving behind no fewer than 10 sons by a variety of wives and concubines. The eldest boy, Ali Mirza, succeeded Haidar after his death. His followers, predictably, wanted immediate revenge. Ali started using the title of Padishah, king, a signal of the Safavids' ambitions toward worldly authority. Yaqub, the Akkoyunlu ruler, wasn't inclined to give them the opportunity. He took Ali Mirza into custody and only spared his life because the boy was his nephew, and his sister, Ali's mother and Haidar's wife, begged for mercy. But Yaqub didn't last long on the throne either. He was dead within a couple of years, and the Akkoyunlu regime splintered as various claimants made their attempts on the throne. One of the claimants, Rustam, tried to use Ali and his followers to support his bid for rulership. Ali aided him, but Rustam too grew alarmed by the potential power of the Safavids and decided to eliminate Ali. Ali tried to escape to Ardabil, the traditional Safavid home base, but he didn't make it. Akkoyunlu soldiers caught up with Ali and killed him in 1494. According to tradition, Ali had had a premonition of his imminent death and sent a message to his 7-year-old brother, Ismail, who was also on his way to Ardabil. "I desire you to avenge me and your father and your ancestors upon the child of Hassan Padishah," meaning Uzun Hassan. "For the die of heaven's choice has been cast in your name, and before long you will come out of Gilan like a burning sun, and with your sword sweep unbelief from the face of the earth." This was a lot for a 7-year-old child to live up to, particularly one whose mother was tortured by Rustam's soldiers for information about his whereabouts and who had to be smuggled house to house to escape capture. Those who hid little Ismail were likewise put to death. The boy finally escaped to safety in Gilan, south of Ardabil along the coast of the Caspian Sea. He stayed there for several years while Rustam attempted to smoke him out, and narrowly escaped disaster only because another Akkoyunlu prince invaded Rustam's territory on the eve of his planned expedition to seize Ismail. Rustam died in this battle, and the rest of the Akkoyunlu contenders spent the next several years fighting it out. That was lucky for Ismail. For now, at least, he was safe. Until 1499, the year he turned 12 years old, Ismail remained in hiding. He and his close associates, 7 advisors called the Al-Ihtisas, maintained control over the far-flung networks that made up the Safavid order, stretching from Ottoman territory in Anatolia, to Syria, to Iraq, to the Akkoyunlu ranges, all the way in eastern Iran. Even though he was only a boy, Ismail was perfectly capable of playing the role of charismatic figurehead. He composed short, simple propaganda poems in the Azari dialect of Turkic. "I am very God, very God, very God. Come now, O blind man who has lost the path, behold the truth." This was powerful stuff. It was a direct claim that Ismail was a divine incarnation, and it speaks to the revolutionary character of what the Safavids had actually become by this point. A religious movement capable of motivating and directing the warlike energies of the Turkomans of the region. This was a potentially massive and extremely capable pool of military manpower. Young Ismail and his handlers were getting better and better at channeling their capabilities. But at the same time, Ismail was also the Safavids' last chance. Thanks to their claim to divinity, the whole order and its networks and resources and followers had become inseparable from the ruling family. That was by design. It maximized the power of their charismatic holy leadership. But this also meant that the Safavids were finished if there were no more Safavids. Ismail was the last one, and he was too young. He was only 12 years old, remember, to have a son and viable successor. If he were captured and killed, that would be the end. Everything rested on this child's shoulders.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass?
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Ismail, as it turned out, was an exceptionally charismatic, gifted, and above all, lucky young man. He was striking, with an unusual fair complexion and red hair, a stocky build, and obvious physical strength and bravery. His courage combined with a keen mind, we've already quoted some of his poetry, and an absolutely ironclad sense of his own destiny and how God planned to use him here on Earth. There was no doubt in the youthful Ismail, no hesitation, all born of the combination of religious messianism and any young man's unshakable belief in his own invincibility. For the time being, there was nothing that could prove Ismail wrong. Ismail and his supporters were stepping into fertile ground for a revolutionary movement. The Akkoyunlu, the great oppressors of his family and order, were in chaos. Multiple contenders for old Uzun Hasan's throne fought each other over a 1,000-mile stretch of Iran and beyond. Now, if Ismail had thrown himself directly into this volatile stew, he might have found either total victory or immediate disaster. But instead, he pointed his wrath north, toward Shirvan, the Muslim-ruled state at the western edge of the Caspian Sea. It was the ruler of Shirvan who had killed both his father and his grandfather, and the territory was strategically vital, sitting at the edge of the Caucasus and shielding the Safavids' traditional home in Ardabil. In 1500, the 13-year-old Ismail led some 7,000 Turkomans, most of them from Anatolia and Syria, from the Armenian highlands into Shirvan, brought the ruling Shirvan Shah to battle, and killed him. Baku fell to the Safavids, and Ismail had his first victory. Just as Ismail brought his soldiers into Shirvan, the two main Akkoyunlu contenders made peace. One of them, Alvand, was determined to deal with Ismail and the Safavids. Alvand led a much larger army, one that reportedly outnumbered Ismail's forces 4-1 into battle. But once again, Ismail emerged victorious, giving him control of Azerbaijan. The young upstart, who turned 14 years old in 1501, took the key city and Akkoyunlu capital of Tabriz. The Safavid Empire had become a reality. Another quick note on sources here. For much of this last section, I'm drawing on the excellent edited volume The Ottoman Empire as a World Power, especially the chapter Ottoman Expansion in the East by Ebru Boyar. A whole world away to the west, Sultan Bayezid II ruled the Ottoman Empire. He was in the midst of a successful war against the Venetians, grabbing key islands and ports that had previously anchored the Maritime Republic's overseas empire. But Bayezid still kept a close watch on his eastern frontiers, and he had plenty of reason to take note, plenty of reason to be worried. The core of young Ismail's army, the one with which he'd won his victories against the Shirvan Shah and the Akkoyunlu ruler Alvand and taken his new capital of Tabriz, had actually come from the Turkomans of Anatolia. Ismail had shown up right on the Ottoman frontier to join with his followers, many thousands of whom were actually Ottoman subjects. Others came from the border region of Karaman, itself an area of concern since it lay between the Ottoman and Mamluk empires. These Turkomen, quote, began to sell up lock, stock, and barrel to leave their home and to help their sheikhs. Another account states, quote, all was in turmoil and they all wanted to leave. it was clear to the cool, observant Bayezid that a new power was rising in the east. He had better keep a close watch. What we have to understand here, a basic fact about this whole region and the Ottoman attitudes toward it, was that it was full of people who could move around easily. Nomads or semi-nomads, the Turkomans who took their flocks of sheep and horses from high pasture to high pasture in the hills and mountains of eastern Anatolia. It was tough for any centralized state to exercise meaningful control over them. They might be Ottoman subjects as far as an Ottoman tax collector was concerned. They might be happy to fight for an Ottoman sultan on a potentially lucrative military campaign. But that didn't mean they thought they were bound to a distant, unknowable, and often basically irrelevant authority. If they wanted to leave, to follow a particularly charismatic holy man, for example, they could and often did. It's not like the Ottomans were offering the Turkomans some kind of paradise. There were constant tensions between center and periphery. And Bayezid wasn't nearly as active or involved a ruler as his father Mehmet had been. The resources devoted to the Janissaries and the Sultan's household and the powerful centralized state had to be exacted from the provinces in the form of taxation. This created a powder keg of tensions, and the Turkomans could be convinced to support a variety of rebellions, pretenders, and, of course, Ismail and his Safavid order. Ismail and the other high-ups in the Safavid order actively encouraged the discontent among the Turkomans. They sent out representatives or preachers called kulafa into Ottoman territory, spreading Ismail's message and what amounted to a cult of personality. That poetry he wrote, "I am very God, very God, very God, behold the truth," was written in a Turkic dialect for precisely this audience. Ismail and the Safavids knew the Turkomans, grasped in a fundamental way how they understood mystical Islam and the image of the Holy Man, and they set out to be that thing. It is impossible to overstate how dangerous this was for Bayezid and the Ottomans. It was a much different kind of threat than the Mamluks of Egypt posed. That was a fairly standard great power rivalry, combined with the added aspect of political primacy in the Muslim world. But Ismail's goals, on the other hand, went far beyond Tabriz and Shirvan. "I shall conquer Anatolia and Syria, and then think of conquering the Franks," Ismail wrote in a piece of poetry, probably around this time in his life. And Ismail's appeal went beyond the usual charisma and the worldly conquests of a successful warlord. Even the mention of Ismail's name was enough to make his followers prostrate themselves on the ground. That kind of devotion and appeal among a large group of Turkomans with serious military potential was an existential threat to Ottoman rule. To combat this, Bayezid forbade migration from his territory to Ismail's. He threatened death and confiscation of property for those violating his orders. When that didn't work, Bayezid ordered the forced deportation of Ismail's followers from Anatolia to Greece. This still wasn't enough to staunch the flow of Turkomans to Ismail, who put them to good use, expanding his new Safavid state. Ismail's ambitions and his capabilities were breathtaking. His first action after taking Tabriz in 1501 was declaring Twelver Shi'ism the official religion of his new Safavid state. This shored up his ideological basis of support, and it is, not coincidentally, why Shi'ism is the dominant religion in Iran today. It all comes back to Ismail. What this meant was that if he wasn't the 12th Imam himself, then Ismail was at the very least his representative, the shadow of God here on earth. This made disobedience to the new Shah, the ancient title of Persian kings, not only treason, but a terrible sin. Again, it's hard to overstate how truly radical this marriage of political power and religious fervor was. A genuinely revolutionary movement that channeled the mystical energies of the impressionable Turkomans and made Ismail more than a mere frontier warlord or a run-of-the-mill holy man. The Ottomans, by contrast, were pretty straightforward Sunnis. So were most of the people in Ismail's new lands. But his most dedicated supporters were Twelvers. And this embrace of it as the official religion bound the Turkomans to him more tightly than anything else possibly could have. It was risky, but necessary, because these fanatical Kizilbash were Turkic speakers, nomads, migrants, and soldiers in a Persian-speaking, settled, bureaucratic world with long traditions of its own. Ismail didn't stop with Tabriz. He took central and southern Iran in 1503, the southern coast of the Caspian Sea in 1504, Diyarbakir on the Ottoman frontier in 1507, Baghdad in southwest Iran in 1508, and Khorasan in the Far East, what's now northeastern Iran, Afghanistan, and Central Asia in 1510. This last campaign included a devastating victory over the Uzbek Khan outside the Silk Road trading city of Merv in what's now Turkmenistan. A vastly outnumbered Safavid force ambushed the Uzbeks and killed the Uzbek Khan himself, whose skull was turned into a gilded drinking cup for Ismail to mark the victory. To give you some sense of the scale involved here, Merv is some 1,400 miles as the crow flies from Diyarbakir across incredibly difficult terrain. That's how far Ismail was operating. That next year, 1511, Ismail's armies went still further to Bukhara and Samarkand in what's now Uzbekistan. In less than a decade, Ismail had extended his rule across seven modern countries, from Turkey in the west to Turkmenistan in the east. In short, Ismail was easily the greatest conqueror in the region since Tamerlane. He turned 25 years old in 1512. There were setbacks and limitations, of course. The Safavid alliance with the Timurid, meaning descendant of Tamerlane, Prince Babur, the future conqueror of India and founder of the Mughal dynasty, failed against the Uzbeks at Bukhara and Samarkand. It was so far from the core of Safavid power. Baghdad didn't remain under Safavid control for long. Internally, the new Safavid state had a massive fault line. Between the Turkoman Kizilbash, nomadic, fanatical followers of Ismail in his incarnation as religious military leader, and the settled Persian administrative and bureaucratic elite, who saw Ismail as simply another in a long line of Persian monarchs going all the way back to pre-Islamic times. But as long as Ismail was undefeated on the field of battle, as long as the empire was expanding, then his charisma and aura of invincibility could paper over any divisions and structural tensions. A clash with the Ottomans was inevitable. Ismail had actually passed through Ottoman territory with an army in 1507 on his way to campaign in southeastern Anatolia. Bayezid kept watch with an army of his own but didn't intervene. Selim, Bayezid's son and future successor, took more active measures. He fought a low-level war of raids and incursions into Safavid territory from his base at Trebizond on the Black Sea coast, against his father Bayezid's wishes. Meanwhile, Ismail made sure that Bayezid knew of his successes. After killing the Uzbek Khan outside Merv in 1510 and taking the skull, Ismail stuffed the skin with straw and sent the trophy to Bayezid. It's hard not to see the implication. Still, Bayezid didn't act. And his son Selim grew more and more frustrated with his father's passivity in the face of the obvious danger. In 1511, the same year Safavid armies reached their furthest point to the east at Samarkand, a revolt exploded in the Ottoman-held parts of eastern Anatolia. It was led by a Sufi mystic named Şakulu. Damningly, from the Ottoman perspective, Şakulu was the son of a close associate of Ismail's father, Sheikh Haydar. This associate of Haydar's had been responsible for spreading Safavid propaganda in Anatolia. Şakulu's rebellion was serious. It attracted followers not just among the nomadic Turkomans, but even among disgruntled Sipahis, the land-holding cavalry who formed the backbone of the Ottoman military and social order. Death and destruction spread across the region until Ottoman armies destroyed the rebels in open battle and killed their dervish leader, Şakulu. Now, there was no direct proof that the Safavids had been involved in the revolt, but there was the fact of Shakulu's father's association. On top of that, many of the survivors fled east to Ismail's domains. Finally, you didn't have to be a genius to connect the dots between a religious extremist's rebellion and the revolutionary extremist state right next door. Even if Ismail hadn't been behind the revolt, he was essential to creating the broader circumstances that made rebellions like it inevitable. If the region was a keg of gunpowder, Ismail was a lit fuse constantly dangling over it, always threatening to drop down and cause an explosion. We touched a bit on the accession of Selim the Grim in last week's episode, but it's worth going into a bit more depth because it was intimately tied to the brewing catastrophe in eastern Anatolia. There had been tensions among the three main sons of Bayezid, Ahmed, Korkud, and Selim, for years. While Ahmed was Bayezid's favorite and owned the provinces closest to Istanbul, essential for seizing the throne after the sultan's death, and Korkud was a respected scholar, Selim was a warrior through and through, a hardline expansionist and campaigner. The Şakulu rebellion catalyzed the final stages of the succession. Korkud failed to identify and crush the rebellion's initial stages, and then his army suffered a humiliating defeat at the rebels' hands. There was no way he could succeed to the throne after that. Ali Pasha, the Grand Vizier and Ahmet's strongest supporter, fell in the final battle against the rebels. Murad, a son of Ahmet and thus a key figure in his own right, was an open supporter of Ismail's Kizilbash and surrounded by Safavid agents. His father, Prince Ahmet, was under suspicion of Kizilbash sympathies himself. He was tainted by his son's open support, and he didn't do much to put down the Şakulu rebellion in his own right. The Janissaries and the rest of the army noticed. Ahmet was soft and cowardly, they said. There was no coming back from a reputation like that. Selim, by contrast, had already built a reputation as a lethal foe of Ismail and the Kizilbash. He was an effective soldier and a warmonger, a man with a reputation for an iron will and a cruel streak a mile wide. In other words, he, not his brothers, had the makings of a viable sultan. The Janissaries knew it, and they refused to swear a loyalty oath to Ahmet. Selim made his move, gathering soldiers and moving on Edirne and Istanbul to seize power from his father. Selim failed. His followers were defeated in open battle, and he was forced to flee to the Crimea and wait out Bayezid's wrath. Luckily for Selim, the Janissaries made it clear to the aging Bayezid that they would accept no other successor. Their hatred, tenefur, of Ahmet made it impossible for him to be a viable candidate. Luckily for Selim, the Janissaries held firm, and Ahmet made a series of increasingly serious missteps. Knowing that the Janissaries were against him, he set about courting the Turkomans of Anatolia, trying to turn them into a power base of his own. When another rebellion broke out in Anatolia, this one directly inspired by a representative of Shah Ismail, and Ahmed failed to crush it, his legitimacy as Bayezid's chosen successor was gone. Selim's path was open. He arrived in Istanbul, and after a week of negotiation with Bayezid, his father abdicated. One account says that Bayezid dangled the carrot of supreme command in a war against Ismail in front of Selim, knowing that his son hated Ismail and his supporters, but even that wasn't enough. Maybe Selim and his supporters threatened a violent takeover. Maybe Bayezid simply recognized that with the Janissaries in his pocket and Ahmed discredited, it was time to step aside. Quite conveniently, Bayezid died soon after his departure from Istanbul. Selim spent the rest of 1512 and 1513 consolidating his hold on the throne. He eliminated first a series of nephews, then his brother Korkud, and then finally defeated Ahmet in open battle. The last two remaining alternatives, a pair of nephews, were executed. It had taken three battles and nine executions of close blood relatives, but Selim was sultan. "Ferocious and cunning," said the future Venetian doge Andrea Gritti of Selim, "and his eyes betray a cruel streak." Selim's accession to the throne had proven Gritti right. Now Selim could deal with Ismail. "How can I turn a blind eye to that tyrant? For otherwise the lands of Rum," meaning Anatolia, "will be engulfed in sedition." Ismail had tried to exploit the chaos of the succession by taking in yet another Ottoman prince and supporting the failed rebellion of 1512. He clearly wasn't planning on stopping anytime soon. This was both a literal and a propaganda war. With Ismail presenting himself as the shadow of God on earth and the representative of the 12th Imam, Selim responded by portraying Ismail, the Kizilbash, and the rebellious Turkomans of Anatolia as heretics outside the bounds of orthodoxy. They were gulat. Now, fighting a war against fellow Muslims was no small thing. There had to be a good reason for it. Making the Safavids and their supporters heretics, gulat extremists, and the enemies of orthodox Sunni Muslims was the key step in that direction. For Salim, this new campaign couldn't just be a war. It was a holy war, jihad, aimed at the foes of the true faith. Salim set out for the east with a large and powerful army, but he had to overcome obstacle after obstacle. The Turkomans were restive and rebellious, so Salim responded with mass executions, the sources say 40,000 dead, and deportations of any with Shiite or Kizilbash sympathies. Ismail came back by pulling his supporters out of Anatolia and scorching the earth in front of the advancing army, forcing Salim to chase him deep into the mountains and gorges of eastern Anatolia and western Azerbaijan. The Ottoman supply lines were stretched to the breaking point. The Janissaries were mutinous. Some of them even fired on the Sultan's tent to express their displeasure with the difficulty of the campaign. Ismail refused to give battle. He drew Salim in deeper and deeper, further away from his supply lines, until finally, the two armies reached the plain of Chaldiran in the western reaches of Azerbaijan, now northwestern Iran. Ismail, unlike some of his subordinates, had no experience of Ottoman warfare. He knew cavalry, horse archers, mobility, war as it was practiced on the fringes of the steppe in the Iranian plateau. When his generals proposed an immediate attack before the Ottomans could entrench their handgunners and artillery, Ismail rejected the plan. "I am not a caravan thief," he said. "Whatever is decreed by God will occur." Convinced of his own invincibility, he went ahead with a frontal assault on the Ottoman field fortifications. Salim placed 12,000 Janissaries, most of them armed with their long-barreled arquebuses, behind a chain of fortified wagons in the center of his line. His cannon and mortars went there too, with the cavalry on the wings. Ismail led his right against the Ottoman left and drove them from the battlefield with heavy losses to the flower of the Ottoman horsemen. Salim was about to flee the battlefield in defeat until the Ottoman artillery and Janissary handgunners opened up. The Safavid cavalry made charge after charge on the Ottoman cannons and arquebusiers, but the red-turbaned Kizilbash fell in droves in front of the fortress of wagons. One source said, quote, "The Persian horses, hearing the thunder of those infernal machines, scattered and divided themselves over the plain, not obeying their riders' bit or spur anymore from the terror they were in." Ismail was seriously wounded. He ran from the battlefield, leaving behind his treasury, his favorite wife, and most of all, his reputation for invincibility. Salim's army, cut to pieces in the battle, didn't pursue right away, but soon enough, they captured Ismail's capital of Tabriz. So far from home, the Janissaries would go no further, but the damage was already done. The Battle of Chaldiran was the end of the Safavid rise. Ismail was still just 27 years old, but he withdrew from active life after his defeat. He wore only black, he drank heavily, and he neglected the affairs of state until his premature death in 1524. He never again led an army into battle. His Kizilbash supporters lost their fanatical devotion. It became something more like the Ottoman frontier warlords than unshakable holy warriors bent on supporting their charismatic leader. The rise and fall of Ismail happened with stunning speed in both directions. The greatest conqueror since Tamerlane staked everything on a single throw and then fell, unable to deal with his failure. It's almost Shakespearean. Salim, meanwhile, turned his attention toward the less difficult, more lucrative business of finishing off the Mamluks of Egypt. Mamluk support, real or imagined, of Ismail and the Safavids proved to be a useful cudgel in justifying the eventual Ottoman takeover of Syria, the Levant, Egypt, and the coast of Arabia. In just 3 years, from his victory at Chaldiran in 1417 to his conquest of Egypt in 1517, Salim had finished off both of his rivals for the rulership of the Muslim world. He had turned back the most powerful revolutionary movement in centuries. He had doubled the size of the Ottoman Empire. Soon enough, his son, Suleiman the Magnificent, would take the Ottomans even further. Suleiman will be the subject of our next two episodes here on Tides, setting the stage for our final dive into the 16th century. The epic conflict between the Ottomans and Habsburgs for control of Central Europe and the Mediterranean. Until then, thanks so much for joining me. Be sure and hit me up if you'd like to chat about anything we've talked about on Tides or something you'd like to see. You can find me on Twitter at @Patrick_Wyman or on Facebook at @PatrickWymanMMA. You can follow the show at Tides History. If you haven't already, don't forget to subscribe to Tides of History on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, Stitcher, or wherever you're listening to this right now. If you've been enjoying the show, I'd really appreciate it if you left a 5-star rating and a review. Tides of History is written and narrated by me, Patrick Wyman. Sound design by Derek Behrens for Airship. The sound engineer is Sergio Enriquez. Tides of History is produced by Morgan Jaffe. From Wondery, the executive producers are Leah Sutherland and Hernan Lopez. Thanks again for listening. Until next time, from Wondery, this has been Tides of History.
If you travel, you know how to pull off a perfect getaway. You know after you enroll with your Delta SkyMiles Platinum American Express card, you get up to $10 back monthly on U.S. rideshare purchases with select providers, like a car to the airport. You know which remote retreats have the best herbal baths and where the Wi-Fi password is rarely used. Because you're the escape artist. It's why you're a Delta SkyMiles Platinum American Express card member. If you travel, you know. Terms apply. Purchases must be on card. Visit go.amex/you know.